Welcome to the Diverse Minds podcast, where we give you the tips, tools, and techniques you need to be a mentally healthy and inclusive leader. Each week, you'll hear about a variety of topics linked to mental health, well-being, and diversity that will enhance both your professional practice and personal well-being.
Welcome to the 117th episode of the award-winning Diverse Minds podcast. And this month, the theme is all about challenging adversity and adverse circumstances. So Friday the 19th of November was International Men's Day, and it celebrates worldwide the positive value men bring to the world, their families and communities, and it highlights positive role models and raises awareness of men's well-being. One of the six pillars of International Men's Day is to improve gender relations and promote gender equality, not only for men, but of course for women too. In light of this, the 2021 theme is better relations between men and women. And a key part of creating better relations between genders is recognizing and discussing toxic masculinity. A phrase coined in the 1980s men's movement, toxic masculinity spread to therapeutic and social policy settings in the early 21st century, coined by Shepherd Bliss, an academic and leader in the mythopoetic men's movement. Toxic masculinity is a term often used to describe the negative aspects of exaggerated masculine traits, and this term has evolved over time and has place both in academia and everyday speech. It is key to interpreting what toxic masculinity is, as the concepts underlying traditional quote-unquote masculinity are complex. To join me to talk about this in further details is Kevin Brazant, founder and CEO of Daddy CPR Limited. He has worked as a learning and development designer and consultant in a broader context in higher education. He's delivered training to social workers and public sector staff for over a decade, and he would really like to open up a dialogue about masculinities in various contexts, work, family life, as part of his niche side hustle, the consultancy Daddy CPR, Coaching Promotes Resilience. In essence, Daddy CPR is a coaching intervention targeting professionals and social workers engaging men and fathers as part of their practice. And it's a training and coaching toolkit training professionals in approaches to engage men and fathers with resources such as learning guides, problem-solving frameworks, and live coaching. The toolkit is very intentional in helping professionals respond to themes of suicide prevention and family or relationship breakdown from a male perspective. And his hope is to extend Daddy CPR beyond the immediate context to other industries and occupations, so everyone can feel confident in responding to men in crisis. Of course, this could be your son, husband, uncle, work colleague, etc. So Kevin, a huge welcome to the show.
Hey, hi, Layla. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Oh, no, we're so delighted you could take time out, because I know you've been incredibly busy with it having been International Men's Day with the work that you do. So we're delighted to have you.
Oh, thank you. Brilliant.
So, Kevin, I've read a little bit about what you do and Daddy CPR, but I'm wondering if you wanted to tell the listeners a bit more about yourself, what you do and why you developed Daddy CPR.
Yeah, sure. No problem, Layla. So my name, let me just start first by just really with an attitude of gratitude. I was raised by my mum and father to really acknowledge and show respect for having the opportunity to really share your story and to speak to people. So really thankful, Layla, for coming onto your platform. It's a great platform that you're doing, and I wish you all the best with it. So just want to say a brief thank you before. So my name's Kevin J. Brazant. I am the founder of an award-winning niche consultancy called Daddy CPR. And effectively, this is a guide to working with boys, men, and fathers for professionals. So I guess, you know, my superpowers are in learning strategy and development and in group facilitation and kind of really looking at problem solving as part of that as well, but focusing mainly on fathers and men. So I'm actively engaged in practice learning as a training consultant. I lecture on this topic also. And, you know, I specialize in reflective practice in particular as part of group supervision with student social workers as part of their practice learning in higher education, really. So that's the main focus for me. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you for your kindness as well. And gratitude back to you in your time. So how did you become, you know, an expert or someone who really wanted to niche down on rethinking masculinity in all its complex forms, thoughts, academic and non-academic sense of that word?
Sure, no, definitely. So for me, it all initially started really back in 2003, where I started working as a development worker with teenage fathers and young dads. And this was a role that I had with the NHS at the time, working in City and Hackney in London. And it was all focused as part of the teenage pregnancy strategy. And through this work, it was mainly around engaging young men and dads, helping them, support them as part of parenting, helping them to kind of really develop, you know, this huge shift in their lives, because this was a big focus for the Labour government at that period. So my career just naturally progressed from there, really. And I moved into kind of developing more work around facilitating dialogue and delivering training around masculinities in all its forms, as you've just alluded to, Leila. So, you know, looking at various different contexts, looking at different cultures and the influence of work and family life and the impact that this can have on men's sense of self and identity. So this kind of developed, it grew, and it kind of really just developed into the kind of niche consultancy which I have now, which is obviously Daddy CPR, which stands for Coaching Promotes Resilience. So yeah,
I love that. That's brilliant. And yes, as you said, it was a focus. And I think sadly, I don't feel that that focus is the same in terms of government support that perhaps communities need. So there's a lot of work that we have to do as citizens, I think, to explore this topic.
100%. Yeah.
And so this term toxic masculinity, you know, what does it mean to you? And do you think it's helpful to phrase it that way? Like how should we all be exploring this terminology and talking about it more?
I mean, funny enough you say that, because I've got a bit of an issue with the term toxic masculinity. I find it to be very limiting, you know, as a term. But yeah, at the same time, it's something that's managed to really hit the public sphere and capture people's imaginations around, you know, kind of toxic ideas of masculinity effectively. So for me, I think it's been helpful in raising maybe some of the unhelpful aspects of what it means to be a man or how men might identify their role in the world. But at the same time, I think it's quite limiting. So I guess, you know, from a non-academic perspective, I think it could be very quick for people to label things as toxic in terms of some of the behaviors of men or boys in society. So some of these things, for example, will be, you know, this strong sense of heteronormative values where, you know, men are seen to be tough, seen to be really abusive, and often is seen within, you know, their relationship to women in particular, about in terms of enforcing kind of male privilege and patriarchy, as well as really looking at how other men are treated as well. And this is often emphasized around, you know, physical prowess, you know, looking at intelligence, looking at, you know, material wealth as well. And these things can be used to justify, you know, men's existence in the world. And I think it's then put on steroids to full effect when you consider how toxic it can be, because obviously this leads to very poor relationships with people, with colleagues, within families as well, and it could be very detrimental within society. So for me, I think it's a problematic term, but I think it's helpful for us to think about masculinity more broadly. But I think we've got a bit of an issue with the limitations that are often put on it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And then this year's theme for International Men's Day was supporting relationships between men and women, or between the genders. Mm. You know, how do you think we can do this as people who, you know, don't have your level of expertise, but what are the kinds of things that we could all be doing? And also so that the onus doesn't fall on one group or one kind of people.
100%. I think very early on, I mean, it's funny because I'm kind of going back to my roots, I guess, so to speak, of working with young fathers and young families and young people. But I think we need to start really early within our family homes around, you know, obviously the first point of call is, you know, you have your parents who are there to kind of model these relationships. And I appreciate that, you know, sometimes we don't have the best models in terms of modeling that kind of behavior. But I think what is really helpful is to start normalizing conversations about what it kind of means to be a man. So I think for us in our homes, we can start by having those conversations with our children as part of family life. I think also that can extend to the work that we do in schools with young people, in youth settings, where we can really engage in a real fresh, open dialogue about, you know, what it means to be a man, what it means to be growing up. I think in society at the moment, although I don't fully agree with this, but, you know, there are very clear messages that are given to men and women about what it means to be a man or to be a woman or to be, a part of a particular kind of gender identity. And, you know, this is, we're hit with this very early on from young. But I think there are kind of, in a way, men, dare I say, are given a kind of like get out clause in the sense that women are given a sense of, and like I said, I don't fully agree with it because it's problematic anyway, but they're given a sense of purpose in, you know, women are geared towards, mm-hmm. you know, becoming mothers, you know, this is what it's about, biological clock, focusing on this. Whereas I think men, they're very clear messages around, you know, playing around, that kind of lad type of image that is projected. And I think, you know, what we could also be doing as part of this process is to be looking at developing a sense of purpose along our amongst our men and boys. I think a lot of our young boys, a lot of our men, and this is across ethnicity, ages, I think feel pretty lost. And, you know, I'm sure we'll elaborate on this a bit more in terms of the stats around things like such as suicide and various other issues that exist in the world at the moment. But I think we have a lot of work to do around, you know, normalizing these conversations.
And I think that's so interesting, isn't it? This idea that society says, oh yeah, women have already got a role from the minute they're born, more or less. And I think women like myself, who don't want to have children, we're looked at as complete freaks. And often men who want to settle down and have children are looked at like, why would you want to do that? You've got all this choice. And people who are transitioning are also looked at in a way of like, well, why do you want to transition? Or, well, you've transitioned. What, like, that's just weird, you having kids. So there's just a real mess, isn't there? I think around expectations and social norms.
100%, Layla. Yeah, 100%.
And then talking about mental health, you know, we know suicide stats, sadly, they're going up and up every year in this country, but it is actually a global public health epidemic. We know that men are three times more likely to take their own life, complete suicide, than women. We know that there's still a large number of women that attempt suicide, but don't always complete suicide. So thinking about mental ill health and culture, particularly around men and people who identify as male, what do you think the biggest challenges are, particularly for Black men and other global majority diaspora communities, in accessing mental health support and being able to talk about societal expectations of masculinity?
Wow, Layla, that's a big one. Big one.
So I like to make my questions easy, don't I? Yeah.
No pressure there. I think, you know, there are some major challenges. And as you've alluded to, I think one of the biggest ones is actually suicide. And I think we need to think about, well, what's leading to the suicide of men across the board? And I think for me, there are real issues, I think, around the messages, as we said earlier, around what we give to men and the messages that they get to people who identify as male and are seen to have to adopt a certain role in society. And I think we're very archaic in that way. And I think around that, what we're finding that leads to the suicide is, I think there was an audit that was done some years ago by CALM, you know, the campaign against living miserably. Mm-hmm. I think they did it in 2019, and it revealed that men are buckling under the pressure of these kind of societal expectations. And I think this is the real issue here. You know, we have, like I said, very limiting ideas around what it means to, you know, identify as male, to be a man in society today. And I think we need to kind of really rethink this and come back to the table and open, you know, the walk to the table of dialogue around this, where we can really think about what it actually means to be a man and accept it in all its forms and variety and diversity. So I think for me, that's the significant challenge at the moment, is leading to suicide, where men, I feel, are not able to be vulnerable. They're not able to express the challenges that they have. We know, I mean, an area that I significantly look at is the impact of relationship breakdown on families. Mm-hmm. That's something I'm particularly interested in. And I find that's when I'm being asked to talk or to deliver training, that's often the area that I find that I'm most engaged in with social work practitioners and other professionals. I think what's happening at the moment is there are very little resources for men to engage in when it comes to, you know, divorce, separation, breakdown in relationship and within the family. And I think we need to think about how we resource these initiatives. But I appreciate, you know, this means a whole overhaul and almost a paradigm shift in the way that we think about support for men more generally. But I think on a very basic level, what we can all do who have, you know, husbands, uncles, fathers, sons, brothers, colleagues, male colleagues, I think we can think about how we can, you know, really coach colleagues who may be in a challenging circumstance, who might be in crisis. And I think there's very simple things that we can do through signposting to kind of help, you know, to kind of alleviate some of the pressure that some men are going through, and to say it's actually okay to kind of feel these things and to be able to signpost effectively. I think one of the challenges that we have, Layla, is that we often give that responsibility to professionals and other people. Mm-hmm. But I think we should be encouraged in society. If somebody is in distress or in crisis, we should be able to say, look, okay, you know, I'm aware that you can go and get some help. Maybe we can do this, or even to kind of look at very basic, simple coaching techniques that are very, you know, solution focused, that can help people to kind of get a sense of agency around their lives and the issues that they're kind of navigating and tackling.
And that's the thing, because I think one of the barriers is that people don't want to be medicalized, or there's a fear of being medicalized. And we know the sad, tragic stories of Black communities and Black men in particular that are over medicalized. They are then put in sectioned, they are mistreated, they are held. So if you have that knowledge around coaching and support with that cultural knowledge in the community, and maybe someone can ask a really powerful question from a place of understanding and empathy, you 100%. Can absolutely really get a turnaround. I'm not saying it's a magic wand, but you can get someone to go, it's okay, I can feel like this is normal. Okay, I'm going to tell my partner that I'm struggling, I don't know what a father should be, or I don't know how to support them, I don't know what they mean when they say this.
Yeah, 100%, Layla. And you know, just to add to that, we're seeing, which I'm really grateful for actually, is we're seeing an increased awareness around peer-led support. And what I mean by that is, you know, there are a number of spaces, and I think these emerged during the lockdown as well because of the pandemic. But what happened was we were seeing increasingly Zoom calls being, you know, done. There were kind of online meetups. There were people that were engaging in kind of very intimate kind of spaces, however remotely, you know, but people felt a sense of connectivity, or they were connected to somebody to be able to talk about these issues. And also we're seeing, particularly in the higher education space, I'm seeing there's been a particular focus on working with Black male students. And you know, and there are two particular charities and organizations that I'm aware of. You know, there's one called Brother Safe Space, which is headed up by Raheem, which is, I think, is a brilliant space for men to be able to come and talk about this. And it's, you know, it's exclusively for men of African heritage or identify as African or Black. And it's a space for them to kind of be vulnerable, to be open, to talk about the challenges. And I also am aware of another organization called Black People Talk CIC, which I think is also brilliant, targeting students within higher education who are struggling with university, struggling with making sense of their position in the world. And I think there's some great resources out there, but you know, they need to be funded, Layla. You know, we need further investment in these initiatives. So 100%.
Yeah, thank you for those. And I'll pop those in the show notes as well. And if you're listening and you think you can fund or think about supporting these groups, then please do check those out. And then thinking about workplaces, certain workplaces have maybe a sense, if we can use the phrase, more male toxicity than others. I'm thinking about trading floors. I'm thinking about financial industry. You know, that culture just seems to prevail. But what can workplaces to introduce the subject of this idea of male toxicity, what it means? I know when I've run mental health first aid courses, generally I get about 90% women and 10% men. And I remember I had a particular cohort where there are about 4 or 5 men out of 16 people, which is a lot. And they were saying, well, we don't really feel we can talk, because when you go to the pub and you start saying, if you say, I don't feel great, your mates just say, oh, come on, you're all right, have another beer. So I was actually quite interested in this, because I'd never really realized that to what extent this was happening. And of course, this is one individual, this is their group of friends, this isn't everyone. But if we can't talk about it in those settings, what can workplaces do to introduce this subject and explore it, and also look at the way the culture is set up that might be exacerbating this?
Yeah, great question, Leila. Yeah, brilliant point. I think firstly, what I found has worked in my own practice in terms of organizations that I've worked with and approached these kind of conversations, I think firstly, having a kind of visual campaign or something visual that enables, you know, people to say, you know, men to feel like it's okay to kind of engage with these kind of conversations and to say, like, actually, I'm not all right. I need to talk about this. So yet again, I mentioned Calm, you know, the campaign against living miserably. And there are other great kind of suicide prevention charities as well, and mental health specific organizations that have got great visuals. And I think, you know, having these things visibly accessible within the organizations, wherever you are, regardless of industry, whether that's in the toilets, whether that's in open areas, I think it's really good to kind of have a bit of a reminder that these things exist. Obviously, as we know, you know, every organization normally would have some kind of an employee or an employment assistance program. I think we should make that more accessible, more visible, just to remind people who may be having difficulties or challenges. I mean, I just want to name drop another great person who I'm totally inspired by, Alan Beck, who's the founder of, you know, the WIB, which is the Wellbeing Indicator Badge. I mean, he did a great TED talk around exploring wellbeing in numbers. And I think these are great people and initiatives to follow. And he kind of talks about a subtle way that we can bring, you know, mental health and those conversations into our workplaces by being very subtle about it. And I think it's done in a way that, you know, we can start to normalize this by making it more visual. And I think if we can also start to foster kind of more opportunities for people to meet and to communicate and to talk, and this doesn't have to be explicitly around mental health or well-being, you know, it can be a part of that. But I think as men, I think, you know, they'll run to the hills once you start talking about mental health, or you start shaping it or framing it in that way. So I think if there are opportunities or activities for team building exercises, for ways that you can build real community, I think then people can connect via their common interests. You see people start to find their tribe. And I think from that, you can then develop, you know, our capacity for compassion, you know, within our workforces. And then I think, you know, once we've kind of been able to foster that, then I think it becomes a lot easier to introduce these topics, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely makes sense. And I think one of the issues is around vulnerability, right? So if we think about some of the things you outlined around masculinities, and then this idea of toxic masculinity, it's very frightening to be vulnerable, actually.
Yeah.
And then 100%. If you're being vulnerable, if you're disclosing or talking about something, and then the rest of the group are like, what? Like, get real, mate. Then it's just a complete shutdown, isn't it? Yeah. So that whole point that you said around, it doesn't have to be specifically about mental health and well-being, but it can be that connection space. I know things like walking football are absolute game changer for people, aren't they?
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, and we can, you know, I think sometimes we have a tendency as human beings to think really big and grandiose in terms of these initiatives. It can be very simple, very effective. It could be done, you know, like I really like the idea of kind of buddying schemes as well, which, you know, when you have a new member of staff starting as part of an onboarding process, they usually are kind of paired up with somebody or they're buddied. I think these are great ways to kind of do that. And you can, you know, subtly introduce other kind of techniques and ideas into that as well. And I think once people feel connected and feel that they're part of something and there's a sense of a belonging, I think then that vulnerability, you can open the doors for that, you know, definitely.
Yeah, thank you. I think they're really, like you said, small yet very powerful and practical things that people can do, so it doesn't feel overwhelming and it's not about changing it all overnight.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
And so, Kevin, you're an incredibly busy professional. This is it takes a lot of emotional load as well. So I'd love to know how you look after your own mental health and what your top three tips are.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, for myself, I always make sure that I do something that I really love, you know, at least, you know, kind of once a week, there's a kind of a routine for me that I engage in. I like fitness. I like writing. I love to journal. So this really aids my introspection and my creativity. So one tip, you know, for me would be, you know, and I get journaling isn't for everyone, but I really like to kind of take notes. It helps me to think about my week, my day, my goals, you know, take note. It really grounds me in my goals and where I'm going, and keeps me focused and up to date in terms of how my progress is going generally. So that really helps with me. Another tip for me also is that I usually allocate a day, or at least, you know, half a day or an afternoon each week, to kind of really turn off my phone and other distractions and try to engage in something other than the usual kind of emails and going out and doing all of that stuff, which is mainly work related. I tend to kind of really like to engage in relaxation. I love aromatherapy and anything to do with essential oils and smellies. So I love all of that. And like I said before, I'm a real ardent kind of gym goer. So I like to really engage in physical fitness, something that gets me perspiring, something that changes, you know, a change of scenery. Going to the park, I like to ride along the canal. I've got a canal and river route near me anyway. So I like to kind of ride along there as well and take in the kind of scenery. So I ensure that I do that. And I also, a bit like what I did at the beginning of the podcast, I engage in daily Thanksgiving, really. So it's a bit of a ritual for me where I mainly in the mornings, really, I start my day just being very thankful and having an attitude of gratitude and taking a note of, you know, the privilege that I get to do the work that I do, you know, thankful for life, for health, you know, my accomplishments, and really invite, you know, future great opportunities that are yet to come as well. So, I mean, those are the things that really I feel fill my cup and keep me energized. Yeah.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you, Kevin. I love aromatherapy too. And I love your tip about switching your phone off for half a day. That is something I really should do. And all guests have their own special, unique ones. So thank you so much for sharing those. Now, if people want to know more about your work and the kind of things that you can deliver in-house, tell us more and how they could contact you. And I will also include those in the show notes.
Sure. No problem. So a lot of my work is, as I said, kind of focused around training, consultancy, kind of really helping professionals to kind of think about these practices as part of their work, and also around how to engage men and fathers more generally as well. So that's usually the focus. I'm quite active on LinkedIn. So if people want to follow me, you could follow me by looking for Kevin Brazant, surname spelled B-R-A-Z-A-N-T. Daddy CPR also has a dedicated page on there as well, as a bit of a blog, if people want to be kept up to date with what we're doing. And that's all on LinkedIn. You can find me by searching for my name as well on Twitter. I'm there as well. I tweet occasionally about my work if you want to keep abreast of things. And if you're interested in, you know, an all access pass to my kind of musings, rants, general thoughts, do check out my podcast Lounge Academics, which is available on all social media platforms, you know, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and we also have a YouTube channel. So you can check it out at Lounge Academics, and that's academics spelt with a K. So AKADEMICS.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And yes, do check out Kevin's podcast and his work. It is phenomenal. And doesn't, you know, this is a great conversation. We could keep talking. So so Kevin, thank you so much for your time, your insights, your wisdoms, and the practical information that you've given listeners.
Oh, thank you, Leila. It's been great to be here, and the journey continues. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. And listeners, do stay tuned. Next time, we will be talking to award-winning author Dipti Tate about grief and loss and how you can turn your grief into fuel. So until next time, we will see you on the next show.
Thanks for listening to the Diverse Minds podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you access your podcasts from. You can also connect with me on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Tune into next week's episode of the podcast, where I'll bring you more insights on mental health and inclusion. Bye for now.